Uploading. Tsunami Black Hole Megamix 2K3, now.
The fate of the whole world is in my hands.
You foolish man. I am Ajito Ryo Master. Allow me to reunite you with your ancestors.
Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am, of course, your Primetime host, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and I welcome you to episode 32 of The Prerogative. On this episode, we cover an anime which I feel could quite possibly be an anime that would be on Toonami as we segue from Toonami Month into Ecchi Month. This anime came out in 2008. Its second season came out in 2009. Even though I initially thought it came out in 2010. Oops, my fault. But the anime I'm talking about is the sci-fi epic Birdie the Mighty Decode. This anime is actually based off a manga that initially came out in 1988. It actually had an OVA in the mid-90s. But of course, the first attempt at the manga that started in 1988 was stopped by the artist when he lost track. He did a remake in 2003, which led to this anime, and he's apparently planning a new manga that's a sequel to the remake he did in 2003. Just to goop over the history, but both seasons licensed by Funimation, which we are covering today. And with that being said, let's get right into it, since we have no emails and comments, and let's get into cast and synopsis. First, for cast, we have Lucy Christian, we've seen the main lead of Birdie, Seafon, Ultra. Michael Sosad as Tsutomaro Senkawa. Brianna Palencia is Sayaka Nakatsugi. Eric Val voices Nataru Shimiyu. J. Michael Tatum voices Tuto. Christopher R. Sabat voices Skeletoso. Tob Happicorn voices Sagita Sayama. Chris Patton voices Valak. And Jennifer Sermon voices Violin. Synopsis. Birdie Seafon Ultra is an Earth Federation officer who is undercover on Earth trying to hunt down fugitives from the law under her cover as Japanese idol Shiron Ultra. One night while chasing one of these villains, she runs into Tsutomaro Senkawa, who is a high school boy that is part of a explore urban ruins club or something like that, and accidentally kills him, or at least destroys his body. To save him, She fuses his consciousness with her body while the Earth Federation takes his body to be repaired. So now Birdie and Senkawa must survive in the same body as he tries to go to school and have some semblance of a normal life, and she tries to hunt down the fugitives who have brought a dangerous weapon known as the Rengeku to Earth. And that is the synopsis of Birdie the Mighty Decode. And let's get right into our review of Birdie the Mighty Decode. Welcome back, and you were just listening to the opening theme of the first season, and you'll be hearing the opening theme for the second season in just a moment, but let's start off with what we usually do. Let's start off with music, and let's talk about the opening and closing themes of Birdie the Mighty Decode. I love the opening themes in this series. I'm hit or miss on the closing themes. I mean, just to talk about the closing themes real quick. They're pretty substandard. I say that because, you know, they're fairly typical, you know, sort of nice song, closing theme. And really, I just found myself fast-forwarding through them, to be quite honest. So they really weren't anything special. Now, the opening themes, however, both were very, very well done. Let's start off with the song you just heard, which is Sora. Which is, again, the opening for the first season. I love sort of this J-rock song that has this sense of adventure, and I think it really fits what the first season is. And that's something to say about both openings. Both openings really fit their seasons, and they really have sort of the feeling of the plot of those seasons within, the feel of the song. And would hear there's definitely more of an adventure with a hint of mystery aspect to the first season. And you definitely feel that in Sora. It's just sort of upbeat, sort of jerry. You almost get a sense of flying from this song. Sort of that, you know, we're going on this grand adventure, this epic. You know, that's something you definitely feel within this song, and I definitely like that. I definitely think it fits the plot of the first season because of that very reason, because of sort of the adventure feel of the first season. The first season is definitely a whole lot more positive than the second season. With that, we're going to play, or should I say I'm going to play, the second opening, and when we come back, we'll talk about it. The second opening is called Kiski.
Kumba,
And what you just heard was the second opening. And the reason I wanted to play is because I want you to get a feel for what I'm talking about when I say it definitely feels the more darker and more sci-fi aspect of the second season. The second season is definitely darker, and it has much more of a sci-fi deep mystery aspect going on with it, as we'll get into with story. And this sort of J-Club, Euro-Club type of modernized song that just has this sci-fi... I mean, when you listen to it, it definitely feels like a futuristic song. You know, it almost like sort of the beats in the background, they sound like sort of, you know, instruments in a spaceship going off. So it definitely has this sort of sci-fi feel to it. I actually like the second opening more. I just think it's a much, much more dynamic song. And that's not to sit there again, say that the first song is bad by any means. The first opening, sorry, is a very good song. But I sort of heard J-Rock, like, this makes sense. Yeah, it gives me this sense of adventure, but there's almost this sense of dynamicity to the second opening that is for the second season. And I also think it fits more of the sci-fi aspect that Birdie is. You know, Birdie the Mighty, it definitely has a lot more sci-fi elements to it that I like. With that being said, let's move on to talking about the overall score of the show. Pretty standard for an anime. You know, songs you tend to hear at particular moments. A lot of silence used. Music is really not a big thing used during the series. It's there, but it's really not noticeable. But not in that, oh, it's not overpowering the series. But at the same point in time, it doesn't feel like it's influencing any aspect of the series. It just seems to be there. The feelings and emotions of the series tend to come more from the characters and the story on screen. Again, which is a good thing. But like I said, there doesn't seem to be really any sort of additional feelings added on from the music, any emotions added from the music that enhance any of the scenes that go on in the series. So, for that, I have to say that the overall score is pretty substandard. With that, let's move on to animation. And first off, let's talk about the overall style of Birdie the Mighty Decode. There's definitely sort of this, again, this watercolor, kind of pale style to Birdie. A lot of use of soft lines and soft colors. There's not really much bold, I mean, there's bright colors, but there's really no bold colors here, and there's no bold lines. A lot of the animation is sort of very soft felt-like. A lot of soft lines, a soft palette of colors. That's why I say sort of that feel of sort of that watercolor style of animation that you probably would notice from things like, I'm trying to think off the top of my head. There's one I'm trying to think of and I really can't remember it. Well, Heavy Metal is one that sort of used that sort of watercolor style, but there's a particular anime, and it's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember it, and so I apologize, and I'll move on. But yeah, it definitely has that sort of watercolor style to its overall animation. And it's not that it's bad, it's very good animation, but there, especially in the second season, mind you, seems to be a lot of places where it's obvious that sort of maybe they ran out of money for animation. You know, and a lot of this has to do with fights, and the fights become that sort of watercolor, sort of blurred aspect to it, and it's, if all the fights were like that, I would understand that sort of, I guess, to represent sort of the speed and sort of brutality of the fights, but in this case, it just looks like they ran out of money, especially in the second season, they look like they ran out of money, and, you know, they had to pick which scenes they had intense animation for. really a lot of this actually happens in the final fight scenes of the series, which really kind of hurts it. You know, there were a lot of things that raised red flags in my mind towards the end of the series, and that being one of them, where the fights started to have sort of this blurred sort of watercolor type of fight style to them. And they just seemed out of place. And I say this because the fights in the first season, for that matter, were very well fleshed out and very well detailed. You could follow everything that was going on in the fights. It was never this sort of blur that you see in the second season. With that, let's move on to character designs. And let's start off with Birdie Seafon, Ultra, and of course her alter ego, Siron, the Japanese idol. I love sort of the color aspects of Birdie. You know, again, hair, really good job to make her look different with the pink and, I guess, purple with the feel that's in her hair. I love that she's sort of this very sort of slim, sort of athletic type of female character. It really makes me believe in sort of the action that she's doing on screen. So I love that aspect of her design. And again, like I said, I love sort of the color schemes. You know, the use of white and pink. And sort of a pastel yellow. I think it really makes the character stand out. And then, of course, Birdie's alter ego that you have, Siron, which is, again, I love, you know, just changing the hair, making it brown. It's these subtle little changes where it feels like Birdie, but at the same time, it looks like a different character at the same time. So I love those differences of the character. Moving on, we have Tetsumo Senkawa, who is the, you know, other main protagonist in the show. He has a very average look to him, but I like that about this character design because I think it balances out the sensationalness of Birdie's design. You know, even though they're using sort of pale colors and soft colors and stuff like that, you know, Birdie's design is definitely the brightest of, you know, all the designs. Pretty much all of the designs have sort of a sort of realistic, earth-grounded look to them. And this helps, I think, Birdie's design stand out more. And you definitely see this in Senkawa's design. He just looks like the average sort of Japanese high school boy. And not sort of this weak, perverted one or this super strong one. Just sort of the average boy that has his own problems and, you know, just trying to make it through high school. And so I definitely love sort of that groundedness that is in his design. Senkawa's classmates is the next group of character designs we'll talk about. I definitely like them, again, that sort of rounded-to-earth design. And the other aspects is, again, each character has sort of their own part to play within the story and, you know, being his friends and stuff like that. And their designs definitely fit those aspects. Like, his sort of, you know, his bossy sort of friend, female friend of... She's not a snotty, but, you know, she's sort of very bossy, and yet she's also upbeat, and she has red hair, and so you see it in her design, and like I said, in red hair, and sort of her toned body, and everything, and just the way she, you know, is drawn and moves throughout the series. And so she looks like the bossy character. His friend is sort of that I-don't-give-a-damn type of friend. Has that sort of I don't give a damn look to his design. His sort of soft-spoken, nerdy friend, who's a sort of a book nerd, looks like a book nerd, and so on and so on. You know, is a club president who's a pervert. Well, I say pervert, but not pervert in that he looks at that stuff, but like that he's a Shiron Ultra mega fan. You know, he looks like an otaku. You know, he has glasses, he has a headband, and everything. He has a backpack, that sort of standard sort of otaku look that you see in Japan. So they definitely fit, you know, their character's personality and what their purpose in the story is. The Earth Federation is the next group of characters, and these are the characters I actually like the most as far as design-wise, because they are very interesting. It's that idea of, you know, sort of alien species being based off animals. So, like, when you are on Birdie's home planet, you'll see, like, people, like, there's a rooster person, and there's a dog person, and there's, like, all sorts of different animals as people. But in this case, her Earth Federation members, some of them I'm blanking on the name, so I apologize, but you know her chief is this sort of giant, like, grasshopper type of character, even though you only see his face, and that's the only reason you sort of know it's a grasshopper. But yeah, or should I say, isn't he a cricket? I think they make mention that he's sort of like a cricket, because there's a scene in the second season where Senkawa is actually trapped in, well, we know he's trapped, but usually in the series, what happens is, you know, when Birdie has control of the body, it's her body. But when Senkawa does, it turns into his body. And so the bodies switch back and forth. In the second season, there's an instance where sort of in her mind, Birdie is unconscious. And so Senkawa is trapped in Birdie's body. So he has to do all his her modeling things. And there's an instance where she's apparently on this sort of bikini game show from Japan, which they do actually happen, but it's sort of this fear factor moment where he has to eat crickets. So that's where I get that sense of that he's sort of a cricket, because they make mention of that. But he also could be a grasshopper. But either way, that's besides the point. That design was probably actually the most dynamic of sort of the animal alien designs. And then Skeletoso and Violin, for that matter, both were very unique. Again, you definitely got this feel of Violin of her being a marionette, which is, that's exactly what she was. She was this marionette. And then with Skeletoso, you, it's definitely a Christopher Sabat character. You know, there are characters you see in animation, and you know Funimation has the license, and you go, okay, that's the character Christopher R. Sabat is going to be voicing. And Skeletoso is definitely that character. You know, again, the whole sort of almost like live skeleton type aspect to him, or at least really only in the head, it seems like it's a skull, but yeah. So I definitely love the designs of the Earth Federations. Let's move on to Season 1 villains. The Season 1 villains seem pretty substandard. You know, the, for instance, Sayama, you know, again, they were sort of these businessman aspects. And even though they were aliens secretly, you know, hiding in human bodies, they just seemed substandard. And really, I actually don't have much to say about their design. Again, they were in human bodies, and I mean, the only big sort of Bane villain is Sayama, or Samalan. I always mispronounce his name, so I apologize. But yeah, and he does have this, definitely this creepy feel with the glasses, but a lot of sort of his personality comes out from the actor, Todd Hapgood, acting in him. His design just seems pretty substandard. Again, villain, he has glasses, he looks creepy. So I guess he works for that reason, but really, outside of that, the villains aren't that interesting character design. I mean, but there's one character, and I'm just blanking on her name, so I apologize. I would have thought there would have been a bigger thing on separately the anime on Wikipedia. There wasn't. There's like no. It was very hard to find who's who, but anyways. And there is one character, she's the one wrapped in the cloak, and she has her little bird. She's probably the most interesting of these sort of villains of the series, or at least from season one. Just how different her design is, and again, like Birdie, she stands out because things that are in her hair, and sort of the more brighter colors that she has. Season two, I definitely like season two villains better. And maybe they're just standing out more to me because, again, they were the last group of villains to see. But again, definitely sort of these aliens who were hiding as humans. I like it because you could see definitely the alien underneath the design. Like, they were had these human designs where you could see sort of what their alien was. Like, one was sort of this colonel who was sort of a dog alien. And you definitely got the sense of this, like, big dog type of person. His partner was a, sort of a cat person. You definitely got this cat-like feel to her human design. You know, the twins being small and everything, them being kids and sort of these sort of creepy twin kids. Well, they start off as creepy, but it's amazing actually how you feel for the characters later, but I'll get more into that into story. But so I like their design. And then, of course, the other sort of villain, he's a villain, but he's not a villain, which is, again, confusing. We'll get into that later because the ending was so confusing. But was Nataru, who's, as you find out in the series, is Birdie's childhood friend and love interest in the series. I love that, you know, he is sort of good guy, because he has a good guy and a bad guy persona. You know, the power that is inside of him that's taking over him. When he's the bad guy, you know, the white hair, and he does look evil. He looks menacing. And yet he does have that sort of normal aspect, you know, when he's good. So I definitely love those aspects of the design. Special effects and background are the last parts we'll talk about with animation. And there's really not much to say. I mean, the backgrounds are very well done again. That color style that I, you know, talked about, again, a lot of soft colors and everything. And almost a watercolor-like painting of, you know, cityscapes and stuff like that. But I thought they did a really, really good job. And the special effects, for that matter, were also really, really well done. Dust, and the special effects that were used when they need, you know, explosions and that stuff. Again, really well integrated into the animation. They didn't feel like they were separate. They felt like they were a naturally organic part of the animation. So I thought the special effects and the backgrounds were both really, really well done. At the same point in time, again, like I said, there's not really any special effects that I can think of in my mind that just pop out and like, oh my god, this is such a great scene. These backgrounds were so awesome. And while there's a natural aspect for backgrounds to be noticed but not noticed, there was no like spectacular location in this series that could, you know, I just pick out of my mind. You know, it was pretty much Tokyo. Well, I have to correct myself. There were the Rengoku ruins. Part of Tokyo gets destroyed by the sort of Rengoku device, which kind of goes off at the end of the first season, but not completely. It's not the Rengoku. It was the Rengoku deflecting a Earth Federation weapon, which caused destruction in parts of Tokyo. And so, like, there's this part of Tokyo, this large area that's in ruins, and that looked really spectacular. So I had to correct myself on that. But with that being said, we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to play a couple promos, and when we come back, we're going to get into acting and story. So we'll be right back, folks.
The funeral is over. Jonathan Kent is on the mend.
So, how's Clark's father?
Oh, much, much better.
Lois has returned home.
Lois, over here!
Harry, wife? Since when did you start meeting your staff at the airport? How'd you know I was returning on that flight?
A good editor checks out his hunches, Lois. I got a hot story of one you want straight away. I'm parked over here.
But just as Metropolis has learned to live without the Man of Steel...
I know, there was only one Superman, but Metropolis just hit the jackpot. Because we got four Supermen now, and nobody knows which of them, if any, is the real McCoy.
Four beings of incredible power and intellect have laid claim to the Man of Steel's name.
The last son of Krypton.
I live.
The Man of Steel.
Man of Steel coming through! Nobody move! This is a bust!
The Cyborg.
Yes, I'm Superman. I'm back.
The Boy of Steel.
Put me down!
Listen, pal, don't ever call me Superboy. Capiche?
The reign of the Superman is upon us. And so, from crisis to crisis, a Superman podcast begins its epic coverage of this last act in the epic Death and Return of Superman saga. Every week, Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor, along with the best and the brightest in the podcasting community, will cover this event in all of its forms, from the comics to the novelizations to the audio drama and beyond. Superman is back, but is any of them the real Man of Steel? Find out on From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, located at www.supermanhomepage.com and www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
And welcome back, and let's get started. Let's go over acting as we come back. And I love the acting, because again, it's, you know, Houston-based voice actors. It's Lucy Christian, Starry Rowe. Lucy Christian, I think, is one of the best female voice actors in the industry today. And she does an absolutely spectacular job in this role as Birdie. Again, just such pop, such energy comes from the character. I really, really love it. And then Michael, as Senkawa, does a great job of sort of being the balance between Birdie's high energy with sort of the down-to-earthness of Senkawa's character. So I definitely love that aspect of it. Again, one of those hard parts, it was hard to find a lot of the voice actors, because again, it was really funny in trying to look this up. You know, it was the only thing I could find was the Anime News Network sort of a list of the voice actors, but even then, there was no detail, so it's like having to go off memory. But like again, a lot of the classmates and that stuff, they were voiced by Claudine Klinkenbeard, and, you know, Chuck Huber, Kathleen Glass, Chris Ayers, you know, pretty substandard characters, and they did a really, really good job. Really, the only other protagonist voices, well, see, there's a hard part, because, you know, Brian Peninsula and Eric Vall, who, they both play good guys, bad guys, with Anna's in the first season and Eric is in the second season. And I say that because they're both good people, but they're characters that have sort of dark undertones, you know, because with Nakatsuki, she becomes the host for the Rengoku, which is this weapon which grows inside a host. And so she doesn't know she has the weapon, but there's like when the weapon takes over, she kill people, but she doesn't even remember it. And in fact, when it finally gets extracted at the end of the series, she has no memory of it. So she's sort of this in-between character. And she does a really, really good job of playing this sort of soft-spoken, sort of innocent girl from a prestigious family. That, you know, as you watch the series, you know, because she's given a second chance in life, she grows. But at the same time, that sort of darker side of her that's growing with the Rengoku. but, yeah, so she did a great job on that, and then, you know, Eric Vall, he added a dimension to this character of, you know, that friend that we know is going down that wrong path, but we can't stop him. You know, he really did a great job of portraying that type of characterization of this person who was deeply, or should I say, had very deep feelings of love for Birdie, wanted to be with her, but he had this thing he had to do that was the complete opposite of what she stood for, and them clashing. And, you know, the times where Eric Vall and Lucy Christian were on screen, you know, even though I know that they did their voice sessions differently. It was one of those things where you could definitely feel chemistry there between the two characters. Christopher R. Sabat, again, played Christopher R. Sabat. And again, it's not a bad thing, but again, it's another great Christopher R. Sabat character. Because again, that great voice, and you know, that tough-nosed character, have to give notice. And J. Michael Tatum, you know, is Tuto. You know, again, he's not really used much after, I think, episode 2 or 3. But, again, for those first 3 episodes where he actually has a form and a body and everything, you know, he puts out one hell of a performance. And his death scene is absolutely spectacular. And I say that in his acting. He did a spectacular job of acting. You know, you really felt for the character when he died. And the same could be said, and I don't have their names here, as we move into the antagonists of four twins, but we'll get into them in a second. I thought the villains did a great job. Tom Happicorn, or say Todd Happicorn, because I think I said Tom. But yeah, Todd Happicorn did a wonderful job just portraying this very creepy sort of prophetized. And when I say prophetized, I mean as somebody who believes he's a prophet. Sort of business owner in Shyamalan. Just the way he went around the series, like, no, just like, I know I'm right. There's nothing you can do to stop me. How pure is the world of those who aren't chosen? There's this very creepy feel to the character, and I really did like it. Chris Patton as Valak, and of course the other sort of villains of the group that escaped Earth during the second season. He was a second season villain. I thought they all did a great job. Again, I don't have their names, so because I couldn't remember which characters. But the two who played the twins really made me feel, and you know, you felt sad when both of them got killed. The spoiler alert for those who haven't watched the series. But when those characters get killed, you know, both, you know, they made you feel for the character. No, even though they probably did these bad things, they were trying to get a new start. They were, you know, again, especially considering the twins were really just these two scientists. And to see them to be brutally killed by Shimiro, or Nataru, you know, it was, again, these really brutal, really saddening scenes. And you really felt for the characters. And again, their acting did a lot for that. Let's move on to story, and let's move on to our first point, which is the main plot. Again, that whole main plot of these two personalities / consciousnesses being in the same body, which is something that has been done before, but not to sort of a sense to where it feels like it's an overused plot, or should I say overused plot device for that matter. But yeah, again, they're really the main plot of both. The first season definitely has this adventure and is more focused on Senkawa, where the second season is more sci-fi, a lot more mystery, and has a sort of detective element, and is more about Birdie. But at the same point in time, even though they both have different sort of feels and styles to them, both are sort of these buddy cop comedies. To an extent. Because really, that's what it is. It's a buddy cop comedy. You know, these two people who are inexplicably different, thrust together in a situation, comedy ensues, along with them succeeding at the end. So again, I definitely like the sense of this sort of buddy cop aspect of the main plot. With the main plot of the first season, again, I love definitely the fact, for that matter, I love the fact that each season focuses on one half of the personalities to make a complete season. And with the first season, I love sort of this focus on Senkawa and him trying to get some semblance of normalcy back, you know, and in the process, growing himself. You know, he is a much different character in the second season, which allows him to help Birdie in many ways. But he has that because he grows so much in that first season. I don't think you could have done Birdie's story that was in the second season first and then done Senkawa's story. You had to do Senkawa's story because he had to grow for him to be believable for what he does in the second season. So I definitely love that aspect of it inside the main plot. But again, just that, and the whole Rengoku, you know, this dangerous weapon of mass destruction, just standard sci-fi aspect of the plot. Again, that's a great segue into talking point two, which is the sci-fi and mystery aspect of the plot. Again, outside of the buddy comedy part, the rest of the plot is just, it's simple sci-fi and, you know, mystery aspects of the plot. I mean, you could have a checklist. I'm like, oh, here's a sci-fi element. Check that off the list. You know, mysterious weapon of mass destruction. Check. Aliens posing as humans. Check. You know, somebody murdering somebody and don't know who it is. Check. You know, so on, so on, and so on. So, I mean, it's not blow you out of the water. Oh, this first time done or something interesting. It's, you know what it is, but again, it is that aspect of, it's very, very well done, and they do a good job at it. I really love that mystery aspect of the murders in the second season, and how it revolves around, and for that matter, twists around Birdie's past. And again, really, that's how they keep the whole mystery aspect of who, you know who done it, but at the same point in time, you're trying to fit all the pieces together, and they do a great job of, like, keeping certain pieces separate, so you are really invested in finding out what's the truth, which they reveal towards the end of the season, in the second season, for Birdie's part of the story. I do, though, however, have a problem with the fairly typical, Taru went back being a time traveler and, you know, at the end going back and he's the one who saved Birdie, who she's secretly been in love with, this mysterious person who saved her so many years back. It's like, I should have seen it coming. It's so obvious, but I should have seen it coming. The next point, and we talked about this a little bit, but we really only talked in the sense of, you know, it being sort of a plot device and that being the buddy cop comedy, but let's get more of Birdie and Senkawa's relationship, which again, both work well off each other. You know, in the first season with Senkawa, you know, being attractive to Nakatsugi and, you know, trying to, you know, find his way in a sort of confusing world, especially now that he's been accidentally killed, Birdie does a lot to help him grow. And because of that, you see him provide a lot more help for Birdie in the second season. And so there's this mutual relationship between the two characters that's really, really well done. Again, that whole buddy cop comedy aspect really done to good extent here. Just not in the, you know, they're both cops in this case, you know, she's a cop, he's a person who's been thrust into this situation, but at the same point in time, it really is a buddy cop comedy. And so, I definitely think they really connected in making the sort of relationship between Birdie and Senkawa, you know, by the way, on sort of that partner aspect of it, was really, really well done, and it really made a lot of the plot believable in the sense of, you know, what they were doing. Final talking point is, as I made mention to earlier before, I thought that this was an anime that could be on Toonami. And so let's talk about why or why not this could be a good anime for Toonami. I think the main reason why I think this would be a good anime for Toonami, and why I initially thought that, was because, again, it was sort of sci-fi elements. I mean, you see bits of Ghost in the Shell and sort of the mystery, at least the way it's handled. Handled by some of the same people, for that matter. But again, it's just that sci-fi sort of action element, you know, those are the type of animes you want to put on Toonami, these action animations. Again, sort of that modern-day feel to it. It would be something different and unique that I thought would really, really fit sort of the vibe of animes that were successful on Toonami, it sort of has that sort of same vibe of, you know, Cowboy Bebop and Outlaw Star. Even though it's vastly different from them, you know, that sort of buddy cop. There's a lot of American storytelling aspects in this series that I really think leads to it having the possibility to be successful on something, you know, like Toonami. As to why not, well, one is, again, I made mention earlier, it's sort of the blurred aspect of some of the animation towards the end, and so that could not work, but, and really, this goes with the second season. The ending of the second season is very, very confusing, and it feels like it's left in a to-be-continued place, except that they never continue with a third season. And so because of that, the ending of the series just feels awkward, you know? It feels like there was, you know, stuff that, you know, there's supposedly this group of scientists behind, you know, everything, and they never really get revealed. All you see is, like, their handler, who's sort of like this guy who's, like, in a Men in Black outfit, and he's got blonde hair and glasses, and black glasses and everything. But that plot point is never resolved, and it's, you know, the entire series is just feels like it's left in a to-be-continued plateau. And because of that, it's one of those series to where it might do well popularity-wise at the beginning, but the ending is something that could hurt people's feelings upon anime. Because again, you want a sort of definite ending. Like Gundam Wing. Gundam Wing has this open ending, but at the same point in time, it's a definite ending. You know, there's a sense of closure. There's no sense of closure with this ending. There's a lot more open-endedness than there really needs to be. And really, I think that was because it was left to be continued for a third season that, for whatever reason, never got made. Or it might be being planned to be made, it just hasn't been made yet. You know, but again, when it hasn't been made after 3 years, it's probably not going to be. And all the info I found said it wasn't. So I think there's a 50-50 chance of it being something that could be in Toonami. I mean, I definitely see a lot of things that could put it on Toonami, but I also see a lot of things that could probably raise red flags of putting it on Toonami. So at the end of the day, this is a very, very good sort of buddy cop sci-fi mystery series with a lot of good action, very interesting animation. I say interesting because, again, it's not sort of that standard. There's a lot of softness to it. It's not the prototypical anime you would see. But all that being said, it's definitely something I think people could get into. There's a lot of American aspects to the plot that I think Americans can like. But overall, I think there is an international flavor that people can enjoy with this anime as well. That being said, there are a lot of missteps in this series. Outside of maybe the opening themes, the music is really substandard. The animation gets wonky in a lot of places. And again, the story is just left in this to-be-continued state that is really confusing, especially since you invest so much time in that initial 26 episodes. So at the end of the day, Birdie the Mighty Decode gets a 3 out of 5 from me. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. If you have any comments of any kind that you want to leave me or let me know about, remember there are several ways you can leave, you know, stuff like fan mail, hate mail, comments, anything like that. First of all, you can do so by sending me an email at absolution132@yahoo.com. You can also leave us a message on our Facebook page, which you can do by going to Facebook and searching for Absolution Network, like our page, and leave us a comment. And, of course, you can always leave a comment on the site, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. And of course, while you're there, remember to check out all our other sites as part of 132 Productions, which include, you know, Chris's random Redbox reviews and Flashpoint, along with Mean Gene's new anime video podcast that he does, course, Geek It Out Light. And, of course, my other shows that I do, which include Tokyo SOS, a Godzilla podcast, which you can find at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my Comic Book Crazy podcasting network, which has several podcasts on there, which you can find at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're there, we have our friends on the sidebar of the site. Check them out as well. They do a lot of good stuff. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey's views from the Long Box and From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Schlechter's Major Spoilers podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner's 2 True Freaks, along with all other friends on the sidebar of the site. Check them out. They do a wonderful job as well. And that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, we start Ecchi Month with probably the most well-known Ecchi title of all times. Yes, that is right. Next week, we get our Battle Vixen vibe feel on as I start to piss off 90% of the anime fandom on the internet when we review Ikitosen. So until next time, my Tsunami generation, stay golden.
Accursed samurai. You have succeeded again in eluding my effort. But I am not worried. For one day you will fail.
DJ Clark Nova, don't sleep on it.